Okay? All right, unconditional surrender. What we have been talking about here is you look at wars. When wars are over, there's winners and there's losers, and usually the loser is forced into a surrender, but usually an unconditional surrender, okay? And the terms of an unconditional surrender we've been looking at each time are the terms that basically say that there are no guarantees to the surrendering party. In other words, it's a you take what you get, okay, because you lost, all right? And with that, there is also an understanding that if you do not unconditionally surrender, there is a threat of complete destruction, extermination, or annihilation. Or simply put, it's basically erasing one completely. It is total destruction. So that's the choice you have. Either surrender or you will be destroyed. What we have been doing is taking that definition or that concept of an unconditional surrender and applying it to a spiritual unconditional surrender. Realizing that, you know, the situation is the same, right? Okay? We, because we have sinned, are lost. The only option for us to be saved is an unconditional surrender, because we have become, because of sin, enemies of God. Okay? The Apostle Paul reminds us that we were alienated from God and were enemies in our minds because of our evil behavior or our sin. The only option that we have is total and complete unconditional surrender. Without that, we are destroyed. The great news that we've been sharing in this study is that the war is over. Okay? The war is over. All it takes is for us to completely surrender to God and enjoy the victory. Right? God accomplished that victory through the death, burial, and resurrection of His Son. Where He basically, what Paul tells us here is He triumphed. He won. Right? Triumphing over evil, over Satan on the cross of Calvary. So the victory is won. The victory is assured. It is ours to choose to partake of that victory or to choose not to and be destroyed. So we've been talking about this idea of unconditionally surrendering in all kinds of different aspects of our lives. That oftentimes there are areas of our lives, and here's where the problem is, that we're willing to give God these parts of our lives, but maybe some other parts that not so willing. And so we want to hold on to those parts of our lives. We have to understand it doesn't work that way. It is a total and complete unconditional surrender, or it is death. So we're looking at all kinds of different aspects of our lives and see, okay, here are some areas that we really need to be willing to unconditionally, totally surrender to God. This morning, we're going to talk about unconditionally surrendering our anger toward God. Okay? It's a big problem for a lot of folks. Many, many years ago, when I was a trooper, I had the unfortunate experience of having to spend 2 weeks on tour duty in the coal fields of Southwest Virginia during the coal strike. The second week that I was out there, I was partnered up with a fellow by the name of Gary. And I was fortunate in that two-week tour to have a roving patrol, okay, where we had a certain area and we just drove 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for 2 weeks. We just drove our route from one coal mine entrance to another. So we had a lot of time, the two of us riding around in the car talking about things. And I remember one time we got onto the subject of God and church and religion and faith and all of those things. And as I was trying to encourage Gary, basically, he let me know that he had no interest whatsoever in God. He was angry at God. And I finally found out why in our conversation when he said to me, and I'll never forget this, he said, "My grandmother was the best person that ever lived. She was a great woman. She was a kind woman. She loved everybody. And my grandmother suffered terribly dying of cancer. How can I believe in a God who would let someone as good as she was suffer the way that she did?" And that was Gary's perspective on God. And he was angry at God because of, in his view, in his perception, God had caused his grandmother to suffer. There's a lot of people in the world that are struggling with things like that. There are a lot of people who are angry at God for one thing or another. One of the things that we need to do, if anybody hearing me this morning is struggling with that yourself, then I hope that you'll be encouraged to surrender unconditionally that anger towards God this morning. But also I hope we this morning I'll give you some tools that you can use to help people that you encounter that are carrying that anger toward God over various reasons. So let's talk about surrendering unconditionally our anger toward God. First of all, there's this whole problem with blaming God for our sin and the sins of others and so forth and the effects of that on us and all of that thing. And we find that in the text that we were talking about in our Bible study this morning back in Genesis. When Adam and Eve had disobeyed God, they sinned, okay? They severed the relationship. When God confronted them, the man said to God, "The woman you put here, she gave me some of the fruit from the tree and I ate it." And so we see right away there's this blaming God for our sin. We talked about in the previous lesson the whole idea of people, you know, basically the devil's the one who made me do it. Rather than owning up to our own sin, we want to blame someone else. And again, that someone else too many times is God. It's God's fault that I did this or that they did this or whatever the case may be. James, I remind you again, we talked about this text a couple of weeks ago, reminds us that when tempted, no one should say, "God is tempting me." That God doesn't do that, okay? He says God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. And that's exactly what we read about in the Bible this morning in Genesis, the story of Adam and Eve, okay? That desire was there. And it led to sin. But it certainly was not God's fault. Okay? A lot of people blame God for all the terrible things that happen in the world. They see those terrible things as sin. They see it as evil that other people are committing, you see. And they blame God for it. All right? Asking questions like this. Why does God allow evil and pain and suffering? Why does God do that? So in other words, the implication here is that it's God's fault that people are in pain and people are suffering and people are struggling. Okay? And then that leads to a lot of people to this question, does God even exist? Along that line of, if there really was a God, then he would stop all of this kind of suffering and pain and so forth. Two quotes that atheists oftentimes throw out there. The first one, people can be moral without God. So in other words, we don't need God in order to have morality. And the second one is, a loving God would stop man from being evil. So if God really did exist, and he truly was a God who loves people and a God of love, then he would stop all the evil from taking place. And so again, if there is a God, then the evil is his fault, simply because he won't stop it. The answer to that is free will. Okay? God gives humankind a free will to choose whether to live in a relationship with him or not. Okay? We again go back to the Garden of Eden, where God told Adam and Eve, do not eat from the tree in the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For in the day that you do, and that implies choice, okay? In the day that you do, you will die. Okay? God gave mankind a free will. And that free will is the ability to choose on our own to do good or to do evil. You see? So God gave each of us the choice. Okay? And the reason that he did that is because he wants his creation, that's us, to choose a relationship with him rather than being forced into that relationship. The only way that could happen is for us to be given a free will. Well, when free will is given, you're going to have some people who will choose God, and you'll have some people who will choose, as we saw this morning in our lesson, that will choose to unite themselves with death. And that's where the sin and the evil and the problems, the suffering, all of that comes from. Okay? So again, the question that a lot of people ask, why doesn't God stop all the evil that is going on? And people will say, well, apparently he's not powerful enough to do that, or he would. Or he doesn't care enough, or he would. The answer to that question is simply this. He will stop it, but he will do it in his time. Amen. You see? It has nothing to do with God's ability or his desire or any of those other things. He will put an end to it all in his time. Okay? Remind you of something that Peter says in 2 Peter 3. Know this first of all, that in the last days, mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lust, and saying, where is this promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. So in other words, there are people that even today are saying, God's not coming back. Okay? He's forgotten about us. He doesn't care. Everything keeps on going the way that it always has. Nothing is ever going to change. He goes on to say this, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. So you see, he will stop it. He will stop it. But he will do so when he is ready and not before. Okay. A second area of this carrying anger towards God is in the midst of calamity and hardship, okay, that we face in life. Again, questions like why do we have to go through this? Why doesn't God do that kind of thing? I take you over to the book of Habakkuk. And I want you to notice a couple of really significant things here in this prophecy. In this conversation that God is having with the prophet here, okay? Where the prophet, speaking to God, asks these questions. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you violence, but you do not save? And understand that the context of this is the Israelites are living in disobedience and rebellion to God. And God is getting ready to punish them. And so the prophet living amongst the Israelites is going, God, why are you letting these things happen? You see, it's God's fault. Why aren't you stopping this violence? He goes on to say, why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? God, what are you doing? Why aren't you doing something about this, God? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. And he's basically putting the blame on God. Why aren't you stopping this, God? He goes on to say this, therefore the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. And so the prophet's perspective is that those among Israel who are doing all these evil things, they're allowed to do it because God isn't doing anything about it. You say? And why, God, are you not putting a stop to all these evil practices? Now, keep in mind, he's referring to that amongst the Israelites. Okay? And listen to what God says to him. Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if it were told you. And then he goes on to say this, I am raising up the Babylonians. Okay? The Babylonians. That ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. They are feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture swooping to devour. And they all come bent on violence. That's what God tells Habakkuk, which is getting ready to happen. I'm sending the Babylonians. Now understand, the Babylonians were the world power at that time. And they were, the term Babylon, even today, refers to evil and wickedness. Okay? And God is telling Habakkuk, the prophet of Israel, I'm getting ready to use these Babylonians to punish Israel. Okay? And look at what Habakkuk, how he responds. Basically, how could God use such a wicked nation against his own people? You see, again, God, what are you doing? How can you do this, God? Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die, O Lord. You have appointed them for judgment. O rock, you have marked them for correction. You are of purer eyes to behold than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Now look at his question here at the end of this. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours, and look at this, a person more righteous than he? You see the foolishness of that question? Habakkuk is criticizing God and blaming God because the Israelites are wicked and evil. And God says, I'm going to send the wicked, evil Babylonians to punish Israel. And Habakkuk's response is, but God, how can you do that? How can you send these wicked people to punish people who are more righteous than they are? What a twisted concept, isn't it? To think that, okay, we're not as bad as they are. That's really what he's saying. And how often do we hear that kind of a concept? I know I sin sometimes, but I'm not as bad as, you say. So, God, how can you use someone who is worse than I am to punish me, is basically the idea behind it. Take a look at Job. We so often talk about the patience of Job, but let me clear up something. Job was not patient, okay, with God. All right? In the conversation that, after a lot of the conversation that Job's friends and the counsel that they gave, Job has a conversation with God. He says, I cry out to you, O God, but you do not answer. I stand up, but you merely look at me. You turn on me ruthlessly. See, he's blaming God. Okay? With the might of your hand, you attack me. You snatch me up and drive me before the wind. You toss me about in the storm. That's Job's complaint against God. Why are you doing this to me? And Job's whole perception of his relationship with God was that he was totally faithful to God, and so he does not deserve to be treated this way. So, God, why are you doing this to me? Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Some translations say out of the storm. Okay? And said, who is this that darkens my counsel? Okay? Or counsel by my words without knowledge. In other words, Job, you don't know what you're talking about. Okay? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you will instruct, or again, some translations say, you will answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have an understanding. And God in that conversation goes on to challenge Job's knowledge and understanding of all the things that make the world function. And Job responds to him saying, behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. See? When things are going bad, it's very easy for us to find fault with God in the way that he's running things. Okay, have you ever thought about it that way? You know? When the reality is, we are totally clueless when it comes to running the world. Okay? And what God is basically saying to Job is, look, you need to just let me run things because I know what I'm doing. Look at what the conversation goes on. In 40 and verse 1, the Lord said to Job, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. Okay? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you will answer me. This is God talking to Job. Okay? I don't know about you, but you know, there were times, now there were probably a lot more times than I'd like to admit when I had to go to the principal's office in school. Okay? And you know, the principal is like, okay, here's what's gonna happen. And I'm like, oh, please don't tell my parents about this. Do anything you want to, but just don't let them know. Okay? But I understood the principal was in charge. Okay? No matter what I did, I had no say as to what was going to happen. All right? And that's where Job is. Look at this statement that God makes to Job. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? And again, isn't that what happens so many times? We want to blame God for the things that we have done. And to justify our own actions and our own behaviors, we want to put it off on God. And when things don't work out, we get upset with him, as if it's all his fault. And God reminds us through Job exactly who's in charge of this universe. And especially even when, you know, something seems to be unjust or whatever the case may be, and we need to understand that we don't know everything about that, and we need to just let God be the one who's taking care of things and not attempt to call him to account for what he's putting us through in life as we see it. Okay? The Apostle Paul encourages us this way. When we're facing hardship and calamity and troubles and trials and tribulations in our lives, which we go through from time to time, okay? In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, he says this, "Therefore do not lose heart, though outwardly you are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day." And then look at this, "For our light and momentary troubles." And I've talked about this before. When we're in the midst of the storm, it doesn't seem light and it doesn't seem temporary, does it? Okay? But in the perspective of eternity and the big picture, which we cannot see, they're light and they are momentary. He says those troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. See? That's what we have to look forward to. No matter what the storms, no matter what the calamities or hardships we face in this life, instead of blaming God, we need to understand what those hardships are achieving for us. An eternal glory that far outweighs any hardship we will ever face in this world. Okay? And then finally, a lot of people get angry at God when it comes to the death of a loved one. That's some of the deepest anger that people have at God when they lose someone that they love. They don't understand why. Okay? Why, God, did you do this? They ask those questions. Why did you let this person die? Why did you take this person from me? As I mentioned to you earlier, Gary, and his whole concept, you let my grandmother die, and not just die, but in a most horrible way. And there's a lot of anger at God over that issue. Okay? And unfortunately, oftentimes with good intentions, we say something like this. Your life is just completely falling apart, but don't worry about it. It's probably God's will. Okay? Let's stop blaming God for the things that he didn't do. Okay? Let's just stop. Stop blaming him. You know, we have to realize, okay, again, we say, well, wait a minute, doesn't he have control of us? Yes, he does. But who's ultimately responsible for death? Let's go back to the Garden of Eden. In the day that you do, you will surely die. You see? That's not God's fault that death came into the world. That's man's fault. And death is a way, okay? It is the way for us to get out of this world into eternity. And that's a blessing from God. He put the cherubim there at the garden, at the gates of the garden, after putting Adam and Eve out, so they couldn't go back into the garden and eat of the tree of life and live forever. Can you imagine what it would be like to have to live in this world, this physical world, forever with all of the pains, with all of the hurts, with all the diseases and all of the sicknesses and all of the evil, and not having a way out? Death is God's gracious way of giving us a way out of this mess and back to him. And yet we blame God when someone dies. Boy, we've really got that backwards, don't we? And I take you to the text that Holloway read to us as we began. In the story of Lazarus and his death, when Jesus showed up at Bethany, Martha then said to the Lord, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And isn't that really what we're saying to God? When we're angry at God because a loved one has passed, okay, it's his fault. And that's what they're saying. It's your fault that he died. And the text doesn't say this, but you can almost hear Martha saying to Jesus, I sent you word several days ago that he was sick. Why didn't you come then? You hear what she's saying? It's your fault that he's dead. Because if you had been here, he wouldn't be dead. When Mary comes out a little bit later, she says the same thing to him. I wonder if the two sisters kind of collaborated on this. You know, they're talking in their grief, perhaps. Well, you know, if Jesus would have been here, he would have kept Lazarus alive. Martha said to Jesus, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Okay? She wants, you know, hey, God will do whatever you ask of him, I know. And what is in her heart is to raise him from the dead. She knew Jesus could do that. He'd done it before. And I know if you ask him, he'll give our brother back to us. I know he's going to rise again in the last day, but we want him back now. And again, perhaps maybe implied, I don't know, but it's almost like, you owe us that, because if you'd have come when we asked you to be here, he wouldn't have died. You see? And Jesus' response to Martha is, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. We have to understand, physical death is part of this life. And you've heard me say many times before, we ain't getting out of this thing alive, okay? That's part of life itself. When we live our life for Christ and we totally and unconditionally surrender our life to him in all aspects of it, then we will die physically at some point. But we will live eternally with him. And that's what we have to look forward to. So I think God would say something like this. Stop blaming me for everything. Okay? Stop blaming me for everything. We need to totally surrender our anger toward God for whatever struggles we've had in life. Whatever pain, whatever hurt, whatever suffering, we need to surrender that unconditionally to God and allow that God has a better plan for us for all eternity. And while we're in this life, because of sin, then suffering and pain and evil and all those things are going to take place. And there is no promise to any of us that we won't experience those things. In fact, the promise is just the opposite. In this world, Jesus said, you will have trouble. But take heart, for I have overcome the world. So let's stop blaming God for everything. Okay? And let's surrender that to him. Wesley has a song that he's chosen for us to use as an invitation song. And we offer this time for anyone, if you have a need that we can help you with, a prayer request, whatever it might be, that you can come and let us know, and we will offer that prayer request up to the Lord. If there's some other need that you have, we can't fill it if we don't know what it is, so we offer this opportunity. We also offer this opportunity for anyone who's ready to give their life to Christ, to be a Christian. You can become a Christian today. If you believe that Jesus is the Son of God and you're ready to make him Lord of your life, then call upon him as your Lord, repent of the sin that has separated you from God, and have those sins washed away in the waters of baptism. And you can do that right now, today. Those of you who are with us online, if there's someone out there who desires to become a Christian, all you got to do is contact us. Phone number will be on the screen as we're having these songs. You can contact that number and let us know, and we will arrange with you as soon as it's possible for you to be baptized into Christ and become a Christian. Whatever your need is, now's a great time for you to let us know. Let's stand together.